Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Resolution's 2011 full-year results. Before we start the presentation, could I please ask you to make sure you've switched off all your mobiles, etc., noisy things that might go off? And with that, I'll hand you over to John.
I'm switching my mobile off, mate. There we go. All done. Good morning. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our 2011 results presentation. 2011 was an important year in Resolution's U.K. life insurance project. In my opening comments, I'd like to review the major developments which have positioned the project for success during this year, briefly set the context for Andy and Jim to drill into the operational and financial drivers of our results in 2011, and take a look forward towards the conclusion of the project. We began the year by communicating to the market the overarching strategy for the newly created life insurance group to be known as Friends Life. We also set and published financial targets for 2013, which, when met or exceeded, would support an exit for shareholders in 2014 and the realization of a mid-teen return for the project. We confirmed the U.K.'s new business focus on true life insurance, protection, corporate pensions, and retirement income, and on disciplined management of the back book, which we call Heritage. We took decisive action to exit writing new business in the individual savings market. We also announced new leadership of the Friends Life Group. Andy Briggs joined us as CEO in May, and we announced Tim Tookie's appointment as CFO in September. Other senior executive appointments and internal promotions mean we now have an energetic, focused, determined, and well-incentivized leadership team who we are confident will deliver strong operational performance. I believe the results for the second half of 2011 provide the first evidence that such confidence is well-founded. A number of key operational decisions have been taken in the second half of the year. These include the agreement with Diligenta for the outsourcing of a number of operating functions, which lock in the target cost synergies, deliver additional synergies, and de-risk the group's cost structure. We decided to create an in-house asset management business, Friends Life Investments, which will recapture fees currently paid to third parties. An important internal decision has been the reorganization of the U.K. business into two business units, Go-to-Market and Heritage. The distinct focus of these two business units on returns and cash generation, respectively, further positions the group to deliver the financial targets and also increases the options for a successful exit to the project, of which more later. The results for the year demonstrate strong momentum in the U.K. business, while the international businesses reflect weak conditions within some markets and disappointing operating performance in others. The value of new business in the U.K. for the year was 59 million pounds, which reveals a strong turnaround performance in the second half of the year. The new business platforms selected to support the business in the future are already performing at around the 2013 target levels, which provides a strong base from which to exceed the U.K. VNB targets by 2013. FLG's overall strain associated with writing new business has fallen sharply from a baseline of 392 million to 278 million and is also on track to meet the overall reduction of 200 million by the end of 2013. The financial crisis has negatively impacted the international businesses, with the high-end estate planning market in Europe and the unit-linked savings market in Germany experiencing headwinds. Lombard, a leading player in estate planning solutions, performed satisfactorily, taking market share in a sharply reduced marketplace. However, we remain positive about the estate planning market and the potential for growth in new areas of wealth creation, and also about Lombard under its new leadership. Friends Provident International's performance in 2011 was disappointing, mainly due to operating inefficiencies. FPI is also under new leadership, and on the evidence of the past 4 months, we expect to see this business rapidly stabilize and then progress to capture the opportunities which are clearly present in its main markets in Asia. Turning to the balance sheet, it continues to be Resolution's policy to manage its assets, liabilities, cash, and capital on a prudent basis, and this has served the group well through the euro sovereign crisis. The asset allocation of the group remains prudently positioned. The group's proactive approach to capital management has realised synergies of £281 million against a target of £235 million. However, management of the group's capital position has become more challenging as corporate bond spreads have widened and markets remain volatile. Cash generation of £393 million was broadly in line with our £400 million target, and the holding company continues to retain a £400 million cash buffer. The Resolution Limited Board is declaring a final dividend of 13.42 pence, taking the full year to 19.89 pence, representing a 10% increase on 2010. Looking forward, I would take this opportunity to update on three matters. First, capital returns to shareholders. The company continues its work on capital optimization and modelling the impacts of continued volatile market conditions. By no later than 2012 interim results, the company will update the market on its intentions with respect to the second stage of the capital return programme announced in June 2011. Secondly, the outlook for the 2013 10% target ROEV. The key drivers of ROEV are VNB, investment market conditions, and absolute levels of interest rates. We are very conscious that interest rates remain historically low levels, which inevitably causes a drag on ROEV. Absent a rising interest rate environment during the life of the project, other measures, such as outperformance of VNB and optimising the balance sheet, will be needed to achieve the 10% target. As Andy will explain in a moment, we believe there are significant areas of new business which, consistent with our policy of writing for profit rather than volume, are well placed to outperform their 2013 targets. We also expect to realise further capital benefits from the rationalisation of the corporate structure as we consolidate around two UK life companies heading our go-to-market and heritage businesses in the UK. Accordingly, we remain committed to the 10% ROEV target. And thirdly, exit. As I mentioned previously, the company is very focused on planning and managing a successful exit from the project. We have concluded that we must have a self-managed option alongside market event-driven options, and have therefore determined that the creation of two separate, substantial and successful listed businesses, OpenCo and HeritageCo, is the base case against which other exit opportunities should be judged. I'll come back at the end of this morning's presentation with more detail on our thinking here. So last February, I promised to shareholders every 6 months to show how the company is progressing towards its 2013 financial targets. And on this slide, you can see how the 2011 actuals have fared alongside the 2013 targets. And I now pass the platform to Andy Briggs, CEO of Friends Life, who I'm delighted to welcome to his first year's resolution results, to take you through the operating performance of the business during 2011, and then Jim will pick up to go through the financials. Andy.
Thank you, John. Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be here. I'm going to start by recapping on the strategy we outlined in November, which is unchanged, and then I'll demonstrate how the execution of this strategy is driving strong progress on our financial performance. I'll do this in summary initially, and then cover each of our divisions. To recap our strategy, the key starting point is the market backdrop, where, as we've said before, the UK market has been ex-growth for 10 years, and on top of that, we have unprecedented regulatory change and a challenging economic environment. That requires a different strategy to that traditionally followed by the UK life sector, and central to our strategy is applying rigorous financial discipline. This leads to three key areas of our business, which are key points of difference to our competitors. Firstly, we've set up our heritage business because we believe a dedicated management team focused on the levers of value will grow embedded value and maximise cash returns over time. Others haven't done this in the UK. we believe the focus, the financial and risk discipline of this strategy will deliver increased value to shareholders. Secondly, we have selective participation in the U.K. market through our go-to-market businesses, focused on value, not volume. These are low-cost, 21st-century businesses, each powered by a single main platform. Beyond this, in the U.K., we are exiting unprofitable products, removing all costs, ensuring no cross-subsidies. This is tough to do, and many others don't do it, but a key part of my role as CEO is to allocate capital where we get good returns, and that means exiting unprofitable product lines. Thirdly, we have our international division, where we will set out our strategy at our International Investor Day in the second half of the year. So from a management perspective, given our strategy, these three divisions are the optimal way to run our business. It also facilitates our preferred self-managed exit option in the absence of further M&A, namely separately listing the OpenCo and the HeritageCo, which we believe will deliver greater value to shareholders. So with what I believe is the right strategy, reflecting the market realities, we then need a strong senior leadership team, and I'm delighted with the progress we've made here. The Group Executive Committee is a strong blend of experience with friends, including Evelyn Bourke, CEO of our Heritage business, internal promotions, and external hires, the most recent of whom are Tim Tookie, our CFO, John van der Wielen, CEO of our international businesses, and Rosie Harris, our new Chief Risk Officer. I'm confident with this leadership team that we will deliver our 2013 targets, that we have the team that can take on M&A opportunities that present themselves, and that we have the team that can reinvent the life insurer for the 21st century, ensuring we have long-term, sustainable, profitable businesses. So that's the strategy we announced in November. I'll now show how putting this strategy into action is paying off and driving a strong set of results in 2011. Now, just by way of introduction, I view these results in the context of the two bigger businesses that we bought being typical of the traditional U.K. life sector a few years ago, with high strain, low cash generation, and poor profitability, as evidenced by the 2010 baseline figures here. So we start from very poor profitability in the U.K. We've then set ambitious targets to be delivered over the three-year period from 2010 to the 2010 baseline to 2013, so we're 1 year into a three-year journey. In summary, we're seeking to deliver cash now and returns over the longer term. So firstly, cash, which is the top half of the chart here. Starting at the top left, sustainable free surplus is growing strongly. From a 2010 baseline figure of below 100 million, we're just under 300 million now, well on the way to our 400 million distributable cash target. A key driver of this is reducing new business strain in the middle here, where we are already over halfway to our 2013 target. Cost synergies are ahead of schedule, having secured 105 million of synergies. So that's cash. Returns are covered in the bottom half of this slide. The execution of our strategy has led to a five-fold increase in U.K. new business profitability. International new business profitability is disappointing, largely due to the economic conditions in Europe. In terms of the other two metrics here, new business IRR has moved into double digits, and return on embedded value is moving forward. In summary, focusing on the levers of value that we as a management team control, while there's a lot more to do, I'm pleased with the performance in year one of three to our 2013 targets, particularly as the second half has been stronger than the first half, giving us momentum into 2012. This improvement in our financial performance is because we're making excellent progress in delivering a big change agenda to execute our strategy and transform our business. If we look at what we've actually delivered in 2011, here are the headlines. Our separation integration program is delivering strongly, with synergies well ahead of plan. Diligenta Outsource went live on the 1st of March. The capital optimization program has exceeded targets in 2011. and we've launched our new go-to-market propositions on the target platforms, driving cost efficiency, improving value of new business, and reducing new business strain. We are investing heavily, but we are getting substantial returns on this investment through improved cost and capital efficiency, some of which you can already see in our financial performance, and that beyond this will deliver a long-term, sustainable, profitable business. To show the benefits of these initiatives, this is the chart from our November Investor Day showing the pro forma impact of the £143 million synergy target on the 2010 UK cost baseline of £476 million. In 2011, we have delivered £27 million of synergies in year, which is a £45 million annualised run rate, and we've secured total synergies of £105 million, well on the way to the £143 million target. We're yet to see much of the benefit we have secured come through in our cash generation or return on embedded value, but the longer term benefits of this transformation of our cost base is that we've been able to exit unprofitable products, removing all costs, de-risk the heritage cost base by making it variable, and deliver low-cost go-to-market businesses. So let's consider each of our three divisions in turn. I'll start with the Heritage Division. In November, we outlined our strategy, the key initiatives and drivers of value, and the Heritage Management team have been focusing the majority of their effort on three of these initially. Cost efficiency, as we've just seen, is being transformed with the Diligenter outsource completed on the 1st of March. Done, delivered, with significant benefits. In terms of our capital synergies programme, we've delivered £181 million of capital benefits in the year, which along with £100 million negative reserve release is pleasing. Looking forward, we're well set for our 2012 capital optimisation programme, which will start the process of reducing five UK life companies down to two, namely the Heritage Company and the UK go-to-market companies. Finally, on Friends Life Investments, we've recruited an award-winning fixed income team, and they started in January. The immediate focus is on £12 billion of shareholder and annuity fixed income assets. We are already serving notice on these assets, and the first £6 billion will arrive in July when Friends Life Investments will launch. It's not every day you set up a new asset manager with £6 billion of assets and a further £6 billion to come. This is exciting for Friends Life, and going forward, once proven, we will explore further phases with total potential assets of £61 billion, on which we're currently paying fees of £87 million per annum. That's 14 basis points per annum, a significant value opportunity. Overall, these heritage initiatives have added 1.1% to our return on embedded value in the second half, after the impact of the persistency charges that we signalled in November, and together with the £281 million of capital benefits. This is a dedicated management team focused on heritage, in action and delivering. Let's move on to our UK go-to-market division, starting with our established businesses, corporate benefits and protection. Again, the delivery of our strategy is resulting in improved financial performance. Common to both markets, we've moved to single propositions on our target platforms, exiting old products, and we've delivered significant cost synergies. Our new propositions are market leading, so we do not lead on price. Margins are improving, and the profitability of our target platforms is close to or ahead of the 2013 target levels. As a result of these actions, financial performance is on a strong upward trend compared to the loss-making high-strain 2010 baseline, and with the second half of 2011 much stronger than the first half. There is more to do, but this gives us confidence going into 2012, where we've had a good start to the year and where the key market trends are favourable for us. This is important because I'm determined that we deliver strong returns on all the capital we allocate. Specifically for corporate benefits, we will benefit from automatic enrolment as the second largest player by assets under management, with up to 500,000 new members and a 20 to 40% increase in contributions. And while retail distribution review is the retail distribution review is driving commission term in the churn in the shorter term, our overall 2011 experience impact is in line with the 70 million we stated in November, and this includes a prudent provision for RDR persistency impacts in 2012. VMB was 10 million in the second half compared to 5 million in the first half, so good momentum going into 2012. Specifically in protection, the key market trends are gender-neutral pricing and life tax reform, and our premium price proposition, focused on critical illness and income protection, is well positioned for this. Early this month, we also launched our single-tie partnership with Connells, the UK's second largest estate agency firm, with good early performance. The VMB progression here is even more marked, with minus 2 million in the first half and plus 18 million in the second half. So again, strong momentum going into 2012. The third of our UK go-to-market businesses is retirement income, where we're building a new business. The top half of this slide recaps what we talked through at the November Investor Day. It's a large, rapidly growing profit pool, and in particular, in the top right here, Friends Life has a significant advantage given the size of our internal vesting pensions book. The bottom half of the slide covers our delivery since November, where we have undertaken a number of pilots which demonstrate our ability to improve retention rates, launched a postcode pricing model, and then our new fixed income team from Friends Life Investments will be up and running in July. We are set to launch our enhanced annuity in Q3 of this year, and we'll be ready to launch our open market offering in Q4, making the final decision to do this nearer the time. All in all, we're on track to make a significant impact on our 2013 results as planned. And finally, let's turn to the third of our three divisions, international. For Lombard, although profits are down on 2010, this is a market-driven story. The environment in Europe has been challenging, leading to clients deferring decisions. Our sales are down 22%, but our market share of the Luxembourg market grew from 16% to 19%, and we've had good net fund flows. Margins are also lower, as the sales reductions mainly came in Belgium and the UK, which are largely IFA-driven but higher margin. Our business with private banks has held up much better, which is our main focus, as they will drive the strong long-term opportunity for Lombard. We expect global high net worth wealth to double to over $200 trillion over the next decade, and a significant proportion of this will pass to from one generation to the next over that period. We've had a good start to 2012 and feel well set for the future. It's been a disappointing year for Friends Provident International due to a series of one-offs and a tough economic environment. In terms of our markets, Asia continues to grow, but Germany's been very challenging, and our financial results reflect this, with value of new business down significantly in Germany, offset to a degree by the VMB growth in our Asian business. This performance is short of my expectations, and we're taking action. We need to rebalance the business to focus on value over volume. Initial steps include rolling out a new, more capital-efficient product range, investing in a new international platform, and a step change in the capability of the management team. John van der Wielen joined as CEO across all our international businesses at the end of last year, and he is recruiting further. I do believe that our international businesses can and will make a strong contribution to the group, but there is much more to do, and John and his new management team are gripping this. We will update on our international strategy in the second half. So that's our results by each of the divisions. Let's summarise what that means in terms of cash and returns. Let's focus initially on free surplus generation, which will drive cash. I'm pleased with our progress in growing sustainable free surplus to £291 million in 2011, well on the way to our £400 million target. In addition, we've delivered substantial one-off surpluses through our management actions. As Jim will cover in a moment, That's over 800 million of free surplus generation before economic impacts. In terms of growing sustainable free surplus to our 400 million per annum target, this slide sets out the track to show how we will do that. The levers under our control to bridge the gap are operating experience variances, the remaining UK new business strain reduction to hit our 200 million target, and improved enforced surplus generation, all underpinned by the cost reduction we covered earlier. Investment volatility is a factor outside our control, and overall, interest rates, spreads, and equity markets are less favourable now than they were a year ago. We remain confident that we will deliver the 400 million distributable cash target every year, and that as more normal economic conditions return, the delivery of our strategy will ensure that this will, in time, be entirely from sustainable free surplus. So that was cash. What about returns? This updates the slide we used in November, with the top half of the slide setting out the actual movements from H1 return on embedded value of 4.5%. Firstly, we've removed the negative experience variances that we had in H1, adding 0.5%. Then the main driver of growth to 6.5% is the benefit of the various heritage initiatives, particularly the outsourcing and cost reduction. In terms of getting from this level to the 10% target, the bottom half of the slide shows the levers we set out in November. Improving the returns on shareholder assets as the economy improves will clearly help. As well as one-off capital management and existing book initiatives, our strategy will deliver sustainable initiatives too. For example, savings on asset management costs from the new Friends Life investments will deliver sustainable positive variances. Finally, VNB growth will also be critical to bridging the remaining gap, including growth beyond the individual product targets, where again, market conditions are important in terms of driving VNB in excess of targets. So, we're keeping to the 10% ROEV target, but we recognise that it will take an even stronger performance to get there in this economic environment. So, to summarise, we have a clear strategy to build a sustainable, profitable, long-term business underpinned by rigorous financial discipline. We have the team to deliver. We are executing the strategy by making targeted investments in major initiatives that are driving a significant performance improvement in the business performance. And hence, we've delivered a strong set of results with good progress towards our 2013 targets. I'll now hand over to Jim, who will cover the financials in more detail.
Good morning, and thank you, Andy. Many of you would have seen us present a version of this slide several times before in the last few years. Resolution's UK Life project is first and foremost a restructuring project, and 2011 is no exception. During the year, we completed the acquisition and subsequent integration of Bupa Health Assurance, and in November also completed the deferred elements of the 2010 transaction with AXA, the acquisition of Winterthur Life business, and the return to AXA of the Gough and Tipp portfolios. We recognise that this level of restructuring does pose some challenges when trying to compare results year on year, and also introduces further complexity to the application of acquisition accounting rules. As we run through the results in this presentation, we will highlight these impacts to try and provide a clearer picture of the underlying performance. As Andy has just outlined, 2011 was a year of strong operational performance. Excellent progress was made in the development of the UK go-to-market business, in the outsourcing of heritage operational platforms, and in the delivery of capital synergies. This is clearly evident when looking at our operating profit metrics. Equally evident from our key metrics are the other two major influences on the year: the impact of negative returns from weak investment markets and the return of nearly half a billion of cash to our shareholders. Net MCEV and IGCA surplus are both down on 2010 year-end levels, with operating results being more than offset by the negative impact of investment markets and the cash returned. The balance sheet remains robust, with IGCA surplus still in excess of 200% of the capital requirements. The cash returned has naturally resulted in a reduced available shareholder cash at the end of 2011, but has also led to a 10% increase in annual dividend, as we have maintained the total dividend payout over the reduced number of shares post-completion of the share buyback. Turning first to the IFRS operating result, overall profits increased by over 148% from £275 million to £681 million. This was almost entirely a result of the management actions that delivered over £400 million of one-off benefit. The profit in 2010 was £275 million, but adjusting this for one-off items in that year and for the full-year impact of acquisitions would have equated to a 2010 underlying profit of £366 million. The equivalent underlying profit for 2011 is £277 million. This reduction does reflect a number of key drivers. Firstly, the management actions taken to reduce new business strain resulted in a £47 million benefit to the result in the period. This benefit has more than offset, however, by the £68 million negative impact of economic returns. These primarily arose from falling equity markets, which reduced annual management charges, and from a reduction in expected asset returns on the shareholder assets. There was an increase of £15 million development costs and corporate costs year on year, and an increase in debt costs of £13 million, partly a result of the replacement of the low-cost, short-term acquisition finance facility with longer-term, lower Tier 2 capital. Finally, the underlying result was reduced by £40 million following our adoption of PSO 614, an impact most easily explained by a review of the £400 million of operating one-off items. A closer look at the operating one-off items in the year shows that the adoption of PSO 614, which enabled the inclusion of negative reserves for protection business, led to a one-off gain of £221 million, as disclosed at the half year. This one-off benefit is purely an advancement of profits, which is offset by reductions in the value of in-force surplus arising in future years and by the £40 million reduction in 2011 in-force surplus I identified on the previous slide, also disclosed at the half year. Total profit over the duration of the portfolio remains unchanged. In addition to the benefits of the utilisation of negative reserves, the results also benefited from the release of £71 million of expense reserves. This reflects the cost savings achieved to date, including those secured through the outsourcing contract with Diligenta. The other major one-off benefit of £93 million arose in our protection book, where actual claims experience was again well within our mortality and morbidity assumptions. We have therefore revised the assumptions to a more appropriate level to reflect anticipated ongoing claims experience. Finally, other minor assumption modelling changes gave rise to an IFRS benefit of £19 million. Overall, the management actions which have enabled us to recognise these one-off items made a very significant contribution to the operating result. Looking beyond the operating result, the IFRS profit after tax reflects significant movements in respect of investment fluctuations, non-recurring costs, and the impact of acquisition accounting adjustments. The investment fluctuations in the year amounted to a charge of £261 million, predominantly from widening credit spreads and the return of shareholder assets being lower than the expected long-term rates. Total non-recurring costs in the period of £293 million are set out in the detail box on the left. These were predominantly in respect of Diligenta outsourcing contract and the ongoing separation and integration programme. Costs were also incurred in respect of our preparations for the introduction of Solvency II and in the delivery of the capital optimisation initiatives. After allowing for the add-back of the costs of the step-up Tier 1 capital securities, the STICs, which IFRS recognises as equity, and after the tax credit for the year, the profit after tax before acquisition accounting adjustments was £421 million. The acquisition accounting adjustments equated to a net charge of £452 million, as set out in the detail box on the right. This was primarily in respect of the amortisation of the acquired value of in-force business and other intangibles, net of deferred tax, but also included the gain on the acquisitions of Winterthur Life UK and Bupa Health Assurance. Over the last 2 years, the equivalent adjustment here was a net gain in excess in £2 billion. What we're seeing this year is the impact of having done less acquisitions this year as we then run down the profits that were previously capitalised on the balance sheet. Turning now to MCV. Group MCV operating profit for the year was £517 million, up 25% on 2010. The key components of this were the expected existing business contribution, the value of new business, and the benefit we derive from other operating items. Andy's already covered in some depth the value of new business, so I'll explain the other two key elements in a little more detail. The first of these, the expected existing business contribution, or EEBC, is essentially the unwind of the embedded value in line with assumptions. The increase in the year from £247 million in 2010 to £360 million in 2011 is primarily a reflection of the fact that 2010 only included the Exacta businesses for 4 months. Taking this into account, there were three other comparatively minor impacts. Firstly, changes in the composition of the embedded value increased EEBC by £13 million year on year. This increase reflected the year on year growth in the opening MCEV, the inclusion of the businesses acquired during the year, and the impact on net assets of the return of cash to shareholders. The most material impact was the revision of our expectations of long-term margins in excess of the risk-free rate, which resulted in £27 million reduction in EEBC. Finally, a similar impact, equating to a £12 million reduction in expected contribution, results from our revision of long-term rates on debt. The bulk of the change in underlying, therefore, reflects our expectation that long-term rates of return have reduced in this low economic growth environment. While the expected existing business contribution was primarily affected by market returns, the second of the key elements influencing MCEV operating profit, the £118 million of positive operating items, primarily reflected the operating challenges and management actions that influenced the business. With our interim management statement in November, we advised the market that we anticipated a charge in our full-year results of £40 to £70 million in respect of assumption changes for persistency net of morbidity gains. The actual charge for the year for these assumption changes is £73 million, including the establishment of a provision for the expected impact of the retail distribution review ahead of it coming into force in 2013. Our review of international actuarial modelling assumptions has continued in the second half of the year. A further £7 million of experience losses have been identified, bringing the total impact of revised assumptions in the year to £20 million. As Andy has already outlined, we have strengthened the management team leading the business and have made good progress in launching the new Premier product. The main benefit arising from the review of operating assumptions is the reduction of expense allowances in light of the implementation of the Diligenta outsource contract. The outsource arrangements have reduced risk in the emergence of the embedded value by giving certainty over these operating costs, as well as reducing actual unit costs. The one-off benefit to operating profit of £185 million is consistent with the £200 million we advised in November, the remaining £15 million being a benefit to the value of new business, as Andy's already outlined. As we saw with IFRS, the operating performance only reflects part of the story for the year. Overall, the MCEV of the business has declined in the year, primarily as a result of weak investment markets. The operating profit of £517 million was completely offset by £600 million of negative economic experience variances in line with our published sensitivities. This adverse variance primarily reflects the impact of negative returns in equity markets, which reduced the value of future annual management charges, and the widening of credit spreads, which decreased the assumed profitability of the in-force annuity business. After allowing for £282 million of non-recurring items, principally the one-off costs as outlined in IFRS, a tax credit of £73 million and £49 million of positive other items, principally the gains on acquisitions in the year, the MCEV has reduced to just under £6.3 billion at the end of the year before returns to shareholders. Cash returned to shareholders through the dividend and share buyback in the year amounted to nearly half a billion, resulting in an end MCEV of £5.8 billion. Moving on now to cash. Just a quick reminder, when we talk about cash, we mean available shareholder cash. This is cash in the real sense. It's not required to meet the capital policies of the business must either have been paid up from the life businesses or at least have been declared as a dividend. During the year, cash reduced from 106.7 million to 853 million. This reduction reflects the payment of 476 million to shareholders, 77 repaid to debt holders, corporate costs of 27 million and 27 million in respect of the finalisation of the acquisition of the ex-AXA businesses. These outgoings were partially offset by the inflow of 393 million contribution from Friends Life Group, broadly in line with 400 million annual distributable cash target. This, however, is only part of the picture. To better understand the full picture of how cash was generated, I think it's helpful to look at the changes in the free surplus working capital of the business. During the year, the business generated sustainable free surplus of 291 million, as Andy's already outlined. We expect this to increase in future years, as ultimately this source of working capital needs to reach 400 million a year in order for our cash target to be sustainable in the long term. In addition to the sustainable surplus generated, the business benefited from 204 million of increased working capital as a result of the changes in operating assumptions, particularly expenses, mortality and morbidity. The programme to deliver capital synergies delivered 281 million, which compares favourably to the 235 million target we set. Of these synergies, 100 million was achieved through the adoption of negative reserves, as we did outline with our interim results. Excellent progress has also been made on the integration during the year, including the completion of the Diligenta outsourcing arrangements. We believe that in view of the progress made, the additional capital that we were holding at group level to cover integration risks can be released. Accordingly, we've revised our Pillar 1 capital policy to hold 160% of group capital resource requirements, excluding the WPIC, down to 150% in line with our stated long-term policy. This has freed up a further 172 million of working capital, although it should be noted that this will effectively be utilised to fund the transition costs of the outsource arrangements over the next 2 years. Friends Life Group raised 500 million of lower tier 2 capital debt in the lower tier 2 debt in the year. 400 million of this was utilised to settle into company debt with resolution, enabling the repayment of the acquisition finance facility. Net of costs of the debt raised, the working capital within the Life Group was therefore increased by 96 million. Finally, minor other items added 13 million to working capital. Taking all of these sources of working capital into account, together with opening working capital at the start of the year of 561 million, the total available to be utilised during the year was 1.6 billion. Of this 1.6 billion, and in line with our expectations, the business utilised 130 million to execute the acquisitions during the year, Woolock and BHA, and a further 244 million to meet non-recurring costs. In addition to these planned uses of working capital, the business also had to utilise 352 million of available capital to cover the impact of weak investment markets during the period, primarily as a result of widening credit spreads. This capital requirement, therefore, more than offset the amount generated from our capital synergies. Allowing for all of these impacts, the 1.6 billion of potentially available capital reduced to 0.9 billion. At year end, 0.4 billion of this was released as cash, leaving 0.5 billion of working capital retained in the business to meet future one-off costs and to provide flexibility in meeting our distributable cash target in the future. This position can also be considered from an IGCA perspective. Looking at the IGCA surplus position shows a similar position to the analysis of working capital. During the year, the surplus emerging on an ICGA basis, including the benefit of capital synergies, was 719 million. However, 316 million of this surplus was utilised to cover the negative impact of investment returns. The IGCA surplus was reduced further by 154 million as a result of the acquisitions made in the year, effectively the price we paid to acquire the value of in-force business. The surplus was also reduced by the transfer of 350 million of cash to resolution, which is out of the IGCA group, to facilitate the 2011 payments to share and debt holders. Finally, financing costs and other minor movements reduced the total surplus to 2.1 billion at 31st December 2011, a coverage ratio of 219% and a surplus over capital policies of 1.2 billion. This surplus over capital policies effectively represents a capital buffer of 400 million as we outlined our intentions to hold in June, an allowance of the expected 2012 dividends to a resolution of £350 million, which again will enable the payment of dividends to shareholders and the payment on the DCT, the debt that we owe to AXA, and finally working capital of nearly £500 million. Both the IGCA analysis and the foregoing free surplus analysis recognise the benefit of the capital synergies we achieved during the year. These synergies have effectively significantly reduced the Pillar 1 capital requirements. Pillar 1 capital requirements were also reduced as a result of the progress made on integration, which enabled the relaxation of capital policy, as previously discussed. Similarly, both analyses illustrate there has been a negative impact from weak investment markets in the period, especially the widening of credit spreads. During the year, the widening of spreads and the company's assessment of the overall level of economic risk, particularly in Europe, has significantly increased capital requirements on a Pillar 2 basis. Accordingly, the company now needs to focus its capital management activities on both the Pillar 1 and Pillar 2 capital positions, as it is on the cusp of both bases biting. The cash generation of the underlying business and the delivery of capital synergies were in line with our expectations. However, in light of the impact of weak investment markets in the year and the increased volatility from Pillar 2 basis now biting, and in keeping with the company's prudent approach to capital management, the board determined that it would have been inappropriate to release capital over and above our declared dividend policy based on the position at the end of 2011. We will, however, keep the potential to do so under review and take account of the performance and stability of markets since the year end. Our ongoing review will also consider the impact of planned management actions to further optimise capital and to address the impact of market volatility. Accordingly, we will update the market by no later than the date of the 2012 interim results in August on our intentions with respect to the second stage of the capital return programme we announced in June 2011. Any further capital releases that may be appropriate will still be subject to regulatory approval. Turning then to the regular dividend, as we've previously indicated, it is the board's intention to maintain the current aggregate amount of dividend paid at the level projected before the 2011 share buyback. It's therefore proposed that a final dividend of 13.42 pence per share be paid, taking the full year dividend to 19.89 pence per share. This represents a 10% increase on the aggregate dividend for 2010. To recap, good progress has been made with integration and cost reduction with clear benefits to the operating profits. We maintain a robust IGCA position with high quality assets, albeit that we're now on the cusp of needing to manage on a Pillar 2 basis as well. During the year, we met our commitments to return cash to shareholders, nearly half a billion, or put another way, over 7% of the embedded value. Our distributable cash generation was in line with target, despite poor investment markets. The full year dividend is proposed to increase by 10%, and we remain committed to the return of shareholder cash and keep the potential to do so under active review. On that note, I'll hand back to John.
So you'll recall last year we spoke about, I think it was the half year, we spoke about the range of options likely to be available to exit the resolution life consolidation project. Two of the options, a cash sale and a merger with another life company, depend on the actions of third parties and therefore cannot be relied upon to be available within the planned exit timetable. Of course, they may be available. So we believe it is essential to have a self-managed option which is capable of being executed and delivering the project returns for shareholders. Having studied both a listing of the entire business and listing separately OpenCo and HeritageCo, we have selected the latter as our base case self-managed exit option. Of course, ultimately, we will recommend the exit route which offers most value for shareholders. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to provide a bit more colour on what the two separate businesses, Go-to-Market, OpenCo and Heritage, might look like and the shareholder rationale for pursuing this as a base case exit option. The Go-to-Market business, or OpenCo, will comprise the UK Go-to-Market business unit that Andy's spoken about, the international businesses, Sesame Bank Hall and the associated support services. Its strategy would be to deliver value from profitable, high-growth products through its attractive franchises, both in the UK and overseas. The Heritage Business, or Heritage Co., would comprise the UK Heritage Business Unit, Friends Life Investment, and associated support services. Friends Life listed debt would be in Heritage Co. The Heritage Business would be a specialist UK life back book company which would focus on closed fund consolidation. In essence, we see OpenCo as being a high operating ROEV business with relatively modest cash generation in the early years, while Heritage Co would be highly cash generative but with a lower ROEV. Leverage in each of the businesses will be set at levels appropriate to the underlying cash profile. Hence, a strong cash underpin in Heritage Co, together with its growing book size through acquisition, which should be able to support significantly higher levels of leverage than OpenCo. There will be important ongoing business relationships between the two companies. OpenCo will continue to offer annuities to members of Heritage Co administered pension schemes whose pensions are vesting, while Heritage Co will continue to manage OpenCo's assets through Friends Life Investments. The precise division of assets and liabilities between OpenCo and Heritage Co has not been finalised and will be influenced to some extent by the final form of Solvency II. However, it would be our clear intention to create two businesses with the financial strength, performance metrics, management team and market presence so they both succeed for the longer term. We thought it might be helpful, for illustrative purposes only, and I emphasise those words, to show an example of the financial metrics which OpenCo and Heritage Co might be capable of exhibiting based on the FLG 31 December 2011 MCEV of £6 billion, and assuming that FLG hits its 2013 cash generation and ROEV targets of £400 million and 10% respectively. Of course, the two businesses at exit will be influenced by many factors between now and then, and their financial performance will inevitably vary accordingly. But Resolution believes that the two businesses will have distinct strategic and financial characteristics which will be attractive to investors, both equity and debt. Investors which have different risk, return and duration objectives will be able to invest on a basis which more precisely aligns with those objectives. Each business will have clear and transparent financial metrics, enabling the market to individually value the profitable growth stock, OpenCo, and the secure yield with duration stock, Heritage Co. And we are working towards disclosing standalone financial data for each of the businesses at the company's 2012 prelims this time next year, and thereafter in our six-monthly results announcements up to the time of exit. And although, as you've heard from Andy, the organisational structure of the Friends Life Group, from a management point of view, already reflects much of what is needed to create two standalone businesses, there remains a heavy workload to enable a legal separation to take place. The implementation of the company's ongoing capital optimisation programme is expected to ensure that by the end of 2013, the two UK business units will be divided into two separate life companies, capable of being exited independently. Together with ROL, FLG is now putting in place a programme to fully realign most of the remaining shared service and group functions to either OpenCo or Heritage Co over the next 18 months. And detailed planning work has commenced to ensure that the company is able to implement this plan by early 2014. As part of this planning, consideration is being given to the interests of current and future holders of Friends Life listed debt instruments and the need to ensure each business retains only an appropriate level of gearing in the context of its gross embedded value and its cash generation capability. So in closing, I would simply reiterate our belief at Resolution that there is strong momentum in our UK life restructuring project. I and my colleagues at Resolution remain very focused on overseeing the operational development of the Friends Life Group and specifically on securing a successful exit during 2014 or earlier. And at that, I shall pass over to Mike. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Right, that takes us to questions. Could I ask you please to state your name and your company as you ask your question, please? Who's first? Greg.
Big surprise, Greg Patterson, KBW. Three questions. I wonder if you could just venture a guess what the current capital generation is from the go-to-market business, so we get an idea of how much you have to do to get to that 100 million target. The second one is the protection business. You did your restructuring in the fourth quarter. I was wondering if the fourth quarter run rate reoccurred in 2012, what would the IRR of that business climb to versus the 20% target? That's for protection. And the third question is the 61 billion potential funds under management that you could move over to your new asset management operation. I was wondering if you can give us a feel how much of those funds come with penalties, in other words, where they break clauses and sort of how much money would have to be spent. So we've got an idea in terms of valuing it.
Jim, do you want to take the first
one? I'll take the first one, I think, and you'll do the second too.
Yep.
In terms of the first one, Greg, the short answer to your question is no, we can't give you a guide at the moment in terms of the split of the company. One of the things we need to look through, and the main reason it's going to be 2012 before we get to the finalisation of that, is exactly how we balance the capital, given the work that we're currently doing on optimising it between the two business units. So in terms of the generation, that isn't something we're in a position we can give you at the moment, I'm afraid.
Okay, in terms of your second question, Greg, in terms of the protection business, probably the best way to answer that is to look at, within the business review, you can see that the IRR for individual protection on the target platform was 20% for last year. Last year, 23%, I think it is, of our new business in individual protection went on to that platform. We're now in a position where all of our IFA business is going onto that platform, and systematically through this year, we're moving the Tide partnership distribution onto that platform. The Connells deal went onto it in earlier this month. The others are more back-end loaded in the year, so you can, you know, probably from that get a sense of how over time we're looking to get the vast majority, or by the end of the year, the run rate of the vast majority of the business will be onto that target platform, which achieved the 20% IRR in 2011. In terms of your third question on Friends Life Investments, we set out in November a fairly detailed schedule of the different asset classes of the 61 billion of assets, together with the current penalty periods on those. So I'll refer you back to that. Ultimately, the key focus is getting Friends Life Investments launched in July. As I say, we've already served notice on the first tranche of assets. The first $6 billion of that is arriving in July. We need to get it up and running, and when that's up and running, we will then make decisions on future phases.
Thank you. Morning, Raghu Hariharan from Citi. I just had three questions. The first question was on the available shareholder cash. If you look at slide 30, you had a $352 million negative variance for 2011. And clearly markets have changed shape, at least in the first quarter of this year. Can you give us an update of where shareholder cash is as of, say, last month or as YTD? The second question was really, could you refresh our memory on your hurdle rate for M&A versus capital return, and whether you see these as competing events or concurrent events? And the last question was really on UK capital synergies, where you're collapsing five funds into two. Could you put a number around what that benefit might look like? Thank you.
Do you want to take the first part? Yep. In terms of ASC, the short answer as to what's happened to cash is zero, because we only count it as cash when it comes out of the life funds. Clearly, within the life funds, there have been movements in the period. We've seen an increase in equity returns, which will have given us some uplift, particularly as a result of the annual management charges. But we've seen very little movement, really, in credit spreads in the period since the end of the year. So that 352 won't all have come back just because the equity returns have grown in the market. Exact numbers, I think it would be inappropriate to give, because it's moving on a daily basis. But those are the key elements of the drivers. Equity returns, clear benefit. Spreads benefit as they actually close again. But we've seen a limited amount of that since the year end.
Would that be what, 50%, 40%? I mean, how much of that would you have recovered? I understand it's a fluid number, but...
As I say, materially, I think it would be inappropriate to give a number today, but those are the key drivers. And our sensitivities will give you some idea of that.
Hurdle rates on M&A?
The hurdle rate, Ravi, we really maintain our position that we would not consider any M&A activity which would dilute the target return from the project, and that we would not intend to our shareholders to support further acquisitions in terms of further rights issues for cash, absent a absolutely knockout situation which you would expect us as shareholders to look at. But the hurdle remains a very high test.
Shall I take the UK capital synergies? We're not putting numbers on that at the moment. Suffice to say, as you've seen from what we've covered already, we only invest time and effort and money in initiatives that return decent value, as the 2011 results demonstrate. But I'm not going to give a specific number.
Could I just come back, John, sorry, on the hurdle rate for M&A? The second part of the question really was whether you view the hurdle rate for M&A versus capital return as competing events or not, or are they different things?
I think you can argue that is the benchmark against which you should assess M&A alongside overall returns from the projects. And obviously overall returns from the project come from building a business which can be exited and realised at exit, or cash returns along the way. And you need to look at both in judging the hurdle level for M&A.
Thanks.
It's Andrew Crean at Autonomous. Three questions. Can you give us the MCEV now, or up to date? Secondly, in this room last year, you, I think, described three stages to the project: the M&A execution stage, the optimized business model, and the value delivery stage. And I think you said at the time, we've nonetheless shifted to the integration phase. Whatever that, I think, was meant to, people understood that to only bolt-on deals. But you have now opened up the prospect of an equity-funded large back book deal. Why did you think that was a good idea? And then thirdly, in November, you commented Resolution reaffirms its intention to return a further $250 million to shareholders in the first half of 2012, subject to the delivery of planned capital synergies and the delivery of the in 2011 and following regulatory approval. What's really changed? Since then, and why have you suddenly decided not to do that? I know you talk about spreads, but spreads were no different in November to December. And you also talk about the twin capital peaks biting. Is that still the case?
MCEV now?
Yeah. Based on our sensitivities that we've published today, we would estimate the MCEV to be broadly in the region of $300 million improved since the end of the year. Are you going to pick up on the thing?
Yeah.
And I'll pick the last one up in terms of the impact on shareholders of where we are on Pillar 2. In terms of Pillar 2, clearly since the year end, that will have improved as well, but we would still be pretty close to the cusp of both elements biting in terms of movement since the year end.
So on the point about the four stages, Andrew, we talked about last year, we are absolutely clearly in the integration phase of this. And very active, as I hope you've got the sense from today, of planning for the optimization of value realization as well. We have looked at bolt-ons. We will go on looking at bolt-ons where they make some strategic and financial sense. And ultimately, we will look to build this and develop this business in a way which we think is going to maximize value for shareholders through the project. That means that we will only do so, however, going back to my previous comment, if we are very confident that those hurdles that I referred to earlier can be met, and that it doesn't throw us off course from the building of the business so that we can exit successfully using our base case assumptions by 2014. So I think basically our position remains as it was, and we are getting on with the job of creating the two businesses which can be separately listed.
Okay, so going back to the second question, what changed between the 9th of November? I can only assume it was that you didn't get regulatory approval to hand back the 250. It can be the only assumption.
No, what's happened since is that we have we've found it obviously the right thing to do to look at the dynamic modelling of investment market volatility. We've done that on the basis of the year-end numbers. That's when we capture our numbers. And on the basis of that, and obviously the significant investment market fall-off since we first contemplated the 250 in June, I accept that the position between November and December wasn't a lot different, but when we looked at the dynamic modelling of our investment volatility risk, we felt that it was imprudent, as of now, on the basis of the year-end number, on the basis of that analysis, on the basis of the point that Jim talks about in terms of Pillar 2 being on the cusp, to hand the capital back today. That's not to say that there aren't measures that can be taken to reduce those risks that we perceive today, both in terms of managing out some of the volatility and creating more headroom in our capital, so that we will be able to update the market concerning the 250 and any other capital returns by the middle of the year. We think that on the basis of our assessment of the dynamic modelling, however, that it would be imprudent in relation to the year-end numbers.
Hi, James Pearce from UBS. Just one question about the idea of splitting new business and back book. You talked about the new business in the UK suffering from a market that stagnated for 10 years. You talked about the headwinds in the Eurozone. I mean, the front book part of the listing feels like it's got some big headwinds, and the back book's got an ROE of 5%. Why is splitting the two parts of the group up better than just allowing the rolled contract to lapse in 2014, please?
Do you want to talk about the front?
Happy to. So I think our view, James, is that there are opportunities in this changing market environment to start to think about how we can reinvent the life insurer for the 21st century. So take, for example, the retirement income market. Our view is that consumers are generally pretty poorly served at the moment. The vast majority of consumers end up buying conventional annuities with gilt yields at a 65-year low. So I think there's a whole range of opportunities with automatic enrolment, retail distribution review, where we can start to look at that differently. In terms of the international side, I'd probably rather leave that until the International Strategy Day in the second half of the year. But again, our thinking is developing there. So we are positive about the prospects for our OpenCo businesses going forward. And we believe we can drive those to be sustainable, profitable, long-term businesses.
Yeah, and the market observations, James, that you made, which are completely fair, are the observations that we have made in relation to 2011 and the impact on the 2011 results. I think that, you know, we just take one example. We feel very strongly that the estate planning market for wealthy people is going to remain buoyant for a considerable period as wealth is created throughout the world. And, of course, the geographic focus of that may change over time, consistent with the sort of macro trends. But the market is there, and we think we've got a very good business in Lombard. Just to take one example, there were headwinds in particularly the second half of 2011. But I think we feel that the business in the UK is focused on areas which have natural reasons to grow, natural reasons to be profitable, and in Europe, on very niche markets, which we think are very attractive through a very good business. So I think we feel very confident that the open co, if you like, that we will create out of this will be very attractive to growth-driven investors, whereas the heritage co will be very attractive to long-term yield-driven investors, such as pension funds, who are looking for some sort of matching with their member liabilities on the other side of the balance sheet. So going to the nub of your question, we think that the resolution team can bring very significant value to shareholders by managing and overseeing and finally executing that process because we think that's where the maximum value lies.
Thank you. It's Toby Langley from Barclays Capital. I've just got one question. I think previously you've talked about capital returns plural, prospective capital returns plural. Is that something you still stand behind, or does the plan to split front and back book potentially interfere with that gesture?
No, I think it's unconnected, Toby, and I think that the position of this team of insurance executives all along has been that where there is identifiable surplus resources, surplus cash resources, which are not required to fund either profitable business or to be held back to cover necessary requirements, capital requirements, whatever they might be, working capital requirements to run the business and to protect against things like investment volatility, then our presumption would be to look to hand the money back. And that, I think, has always been our position, and that will remain our position irrespective of how we decide to structure the book in the future.
And just to come back on that very quickly, the timing that you've now put on plan A of the front book, back book split, that doesn't interfere again with that same...
With that philosophy, no.
Okay.
Oliver Steele, Deutsche Bank. I'd really like to follow up on Andrew's question about the absence of a share buyback. Again, it's really not obvious to me how you can give a pretty confident statement in November and then not deliver. As you yourself admit, spreads have not materially changed between the start of November and the end of December. In fact, spreads based on the previous quarter-end date, i.e. in September, have narrowed. So perhaps you can just sort of comment about your thought process in November when you made the statement that you did. The second question, really linked to that, is when you talk about Pillar 2 biting, where are you on Pillar 2? What sort of ratio are you talking about? What are the actions you can take to improve the headroom on that?
Two questions are linked, Oliver, so I'll ask Jim.
First point, in terms of spreads, it's not the movement in spreads that specifically have driven the board's view based on the end of the year. It's the knock-on impact of the overall environment, including spreads, which was part of the movement, and the volatility we see in returns going forward. A lot of that comes from the dynamic modelling that we did based around the year-end, where we've increased the stresses basically through the falling markets, of which equity are part of, where you actually look at the impact for the business of the total outcome dynamically, because we're in falling markets, that drives your capital further. So the key thing that changed was us having the opportunity to do full dynamic modelling based on the year-end position, which gave a higher risk position than we were aware of in November. And that's the reason for the difference between the two. In terms of the second element, there are two elements of what we can do around Pillar 2, which is literally on the cusp, so it's not that it's particularly higher than Pillar 1 at the moment. We're just recognising we need to manage both bases. The key point with Pillar 2 is it is a more volatile basis than Pillar 1 because of that dynamic interaction. So as markets drive down, your dynamic testing drives you down more quickly than a Pillar 1 basis would. In terms of the things that we can do, there are two basic elements to it. One is to look to say, can we actually reduce the volatility of the underlying asset liability matching, which may be changing the elements of the portfolio if we felt that was appropriate. It might be looking at whether we've got that matching correct, have we got the risk mismatch right. Clearly, we're a risk business, and we're here to take risk. And part of what we have to assess is what is best for shareholders in terms of timing, not just of cash returns, but in terms of credit spreads, because while spreads are moving, we're still not seeing significant defaults within the book. We still believe we've got a long-term book, and we'd be quite reluctant to give away absolute margin to hedge a timing difference if that wasn't in shareholders' interests. So that's one element. The other element is to say, what can we do around headroom so that we can accommodate more volatility, given that it may be the best thing for shareholders to do so? And on that, we're looking at what things can we do both structurally, but also for capital efficiencies within funds to make sure that we have more headroom created on that basis. I hope that answers your question.
Hi, it's Trevor Moss at Berenberg. Given the enormous operational and technical
issues associated with splitting the front book and the back book, but also some significant policyholder protection issues associated with that same split. It always been my previous assumption that that was a very, very high hurdle for the FSA to get over to actually do that or to allow it to happen. But the fact that you're sort of announcing that this is your intention, does that imply that you've had that conversation with the FSA and they're happy, or are you just making the broad assumption that you will be able to satisfy them on that issue?
The latter, but I don't think it's broad. I think that I don't buy for a minute the idea that doing this is going to harm policyholder protection in either of the businesses. I don't see why it should. Don't understand the logic of that, and we wouldn't do it. And especially me, I wouldn't do that. So no, we think we can organise the business, structure the business, support the businesses, so that we absolutely meet our responsibilities to policyholders. We think from an equity market and debt market point of view, there is then a much more attractive investment opportunity. But we are very clear that we can go through this process with the support of the FSA on the basis of policyholder protection in both businesses. I don't know, Andy, whether you want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of bring it all back to the strategy we outlined back in November and the focus on rigorous financial discipline. What we're doing here is we're getting dedicated management teams focused on the three divisions within the business, eliminating cross-subsidies between them, and then driving that rigorous financial discipline in our thinking and our approach. And we're doing that anyway, and therefore the increment to do the OpenCo heritage split is not that significant from our perspective. What it does, though, coming back to the one of the previous questions, what it does is, for example, it forces the OpenCo management team to work out, you know, I kind of go back 10 years ago, people today are not saving any more than they were 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we had a $27 billion savings gap. It's a heck of a lot bigger than that now. But we need to work out how we're going to meet those customer needs and do that in a cost, capital and tax-efficient way by removing the cross-subsidies and the cash generation of the back book from the OpenCo business. You're forcing that management team to think about how you crack that problem going forward. And for me, that is what rigorous financial discipline and the execution of this strategy brings, rather than continuing to murk and muddy the waters between the two.
Thanks very much. Blair Stewart from BofA Merrill's. Three questions, please. You talked about the RDR and the change to your lapse assumption. Could you just expand on that in terms of what your expectations are around RDR and how you've reflected that in your assumptions? Secondly, looking at IFRS profits, there was, I think, about $100 million lower contribution from the existing book in H2 versus H1. Is that just a market effect, and should we use H2 as a run rate or not? And thirdly, coming back to the question that's been asked a couple of times, I'm just interested in the conditions that need to be in place to resume a capital return. You've talked about the volatility of economic capital, Jim. Could you just comment on to what extent you're using an illiquidity premium and various other shock absorbers that may be available to you on a Solvency II basis? Thanks.
I'll take the first one. So what's going on behind this, that the primary focus is for us is in the corporate pensions book and business. And over 80% of the schemes that we lost last year went to initial commission players. That's not reflective of our book as a whole, but over 80% went to initial commission players. That's why I'm you know, overt with you that we see commission churn going on in the marketplace. We have another 9 months of it, and then we're back to sensible commercial rationality. We've made a provision for 2012 within the allowance at the end of last year. And I guess, again, this is our rigorous financial discipline in action. So we will not play in that initial commission market. The cash flows, the returns are poor. It's poor financial discipline to do so, in our opinion. Equally, we won't reduce the pricing on our existing arrangements if that takes it to unprofitable level. We'll be prepared to let those schemes go rather than try and retain them on unprofitable terms. So we're just applying rigorous financial discipline. We've made a provision for the year ahead. It is a relatively uncertain environment as to how things will go, but we believe the provision is adequate.
Okay. Yeah, I'll pick IFRS up first, if I may. I think probably the best guide in terms of IFRS is the information we've given around the full year, and that kind of sets out the two elements of the impact. You're right, to a certain extent, there was a level of economic which was far more pronounced in the second half of the year than it was in the first half of the year, driven more by equities than anything else, but spreads has a small impact. And the second element is this, the 40 million that effectively comes off the in-force surplus as a result of implementing PSO 614. So we get a one-off win and future years go down, which is just a timing of profit. So the two biggest influences. I hope that that slide will help you through what the base might be going forward. In terms of the capital, you asked about the illiquidity premium. We're currently holding a liquidity premium of 90 bips. Our view is that, you know, that kind of reflects some element of the surplus, but we've actually weakened the overall amount that we're holding for defaults, i.e. we're holding more for defaults, so we've weakened the amount in terms of the total amount. There is always room to look to manage that to the extent that it's a judgment. But our view is we've taken an appropriate judgment in markets which we think are more severe than the markets we faced at the end of 2010. And that's why we've made a small increase in liquidity premium, which is nowhere near the full blowout that you've seen in spreads overall.
Just come back on that. What are the external measures we should look at to assess the conditions that would need to be in place to resume the capital return? Is it market volatility?
The capital return, ultimately, there's not a lot we can do about market volatility itself. So the two things we need to assess is, do we have sufficient headroom to live with that room? So as I outlined earlier, one of the things we're specifically looking at is, can we create more headroom? Because ultimately that's one way of saying, well, we've got plenty of headroom, therefore we can give capital back. And the other one is, if we believe that volatility is here to stay, do we at some point lock in to make sure that we de-risk elements of the portfolio? But that will always have a cost, whereas creating more headroom quite often is about the way that you manage the business and won't necessarily have a cost to shareholders, and it tends to be relatively permanent. So our preference is always to try and generate things that create more headroom, but we will look at whether or not there are economic opportunities to lock into hedging where that's appropriate.
Would you be prepared to give an economic capital number at some point in the future?
Not at the moment, no, because we've got a lot of work to do around the management of the two businesses.
Okay,
who's
next?
Please. Yeah, Ashik Pasadi from JP Morgan. On slide number 15, you mentioned you attained a free surplus generation of 291 versus your target of 400. And to bridge the gap, basically, you need to achieve more new business strain reduction and improved in-force surplus generation. Now, I'm a bit surprised here that you have already overachieved your new business strain reduction in the UK. It is currently 145 million versus your total target of 200 million. And then you have taken your benefit of PSO 614 so that your inflow surplus generation will be lower going from here. So I was just surprised, like, if I'm missing something here, how do we plan to go there?
So the two points I'd make, the first is that the 200 million is a 200 million reduction, and we haven't achieved that yet. We've still got 70-odd million to go, I think, if you do the maths, roughly. And secondly, we have the opportunity to both create positive operating experience variances and also to improve in-force surpluses, in particular through further cost reduction. So if you look at the cost reduction numbers, we had 27 million of cost reduction in year. That's the only element that you're seeing in free surplus at this stage. Even though we've secured 105 million of synergies on the journey to 143, you've only got the 27 appearing in free surplus at this stage. So the cost reduction is a key driver together with the new business strain reduction.
Okay, thanks a lot. Just a follow-up on that. So this 400 million target of free surplus generation is for 2013?
We've not said that. What we've said is that every year we will deliver 400 million of distributable cash target, and that over time we will ensure that's from sustainable sources. We've not put a specific time frame on the timing of achieving that.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. It's Marcus Rivaldi from Morgan Stanley. Three questions, please. First of all, given previous guidance on leverage pre and exit, what should we be thinking about leverage, say, at Heritage Co. going forward? I think you've previously been indicating you feel you're under-levered. Should we expect a more levered-up Heritage Co. coming to market? Secondly, linked to that, does Heritage Co. work if you've got sub-investment grade ratings at the bond level from rating agencies. So what are you going to do about protecting investment-grade ratings for bondholders in Heritage Co? And then finally, you know, as proof of concept, do you think you have to do deals with Heritage Co pre a listing, or otherwise would people just say, well, you're just a runoff in disguise? Thanks.
Yes, certainly. In terms of leverage, I think our view in terms of Heritage is it would probably be targeted around a consistent capital policy for an A rating, which would lead you to somewhere between 25 to 35% for the leverage ratio. And we believe that is still appropriate for the business going forward. Now, clearly, in the open business, it's more likely to be aligned with equity and it would be a lot lower. But for the Heritage book, that's where we think that would be. In terms of the other fundamentals, the Heritage book is likely to have with it all of the debt that's currently in place because it's guaranteed by the life companies and would go with that. So the protection there is to the extent that they already get the guarantees, benefit from the guarantees, and clearly would look to make sure that the profile of that runoff was then appropriate to the level of refinancing that's required as debt becomes available and that we make sure that we maintain the gearing through that period. So to the extent that gearing would be exceeded on those refinancing points, we'd need to make sure that we had appropriate cash to take the balance out. In terms of then the overall impact of that going forward, we will certainly be looking to work to ensure that we do not end up with sub-investment grade to the extent that that is possible.
Yeah, the third point, so-called proof of concept. I mean, I think that notwithstanding our base case self-managed assumption of the separation of the two businesses, as I mentioned earlier, our hurdle and test for any acquisitions, whether they're in the open side or on the Heritage side, remain as tough as I've described. And we're not going to weaken that to meet a so-called proof of concept. If there are transactions that are consistent with those hurdles in either part of the business, then obviously we would look at those as shareholders would expect. But I think it will be necessary for us to show that as we reach the exit point, that we are building a business which is in a position to absorb other closed life books and will have the financial power to do so. So our criteria for M&A remain as testing as they are today.
Just a quick follow-up. Where would you say roughly your leverage is now within that Heritage structure in your mind?
Our total leverage at the moment is around about 19%. So if you took the illustrative example there and assumed that all of that debt then went in, you could work that out.
Thanks. It's Gordon Aitken from RBC. You talk about the Pillar 2 biting. Now, this, I'm assuming, is the ICA, not the anything to do with the ICG. So it's the 1 in 200-year event. So you've got stochastic modelling, which includes scenarios where presumably a large proportion of the corporate bonds default on the annuity book. You mentioned you'd increase the stresses at year-end. That's the first question. What exactly did you mean by that? Secondly, what level of defaults is the ICA implying? And finally, how large is the effective credit default reserve compared to your annuity book?
In terms of the stress point, the fundamental thing we've done is look at the economic scenarios, and the thing that has changed is the severity of those economic scenarios, particularly with regard to Europe and potential impact of sovereign debt, not the debt itself, which we have very little exposure to, but the knock-on impacts to what might then subsequently happen to bond markets across Europe and to what might happen across equity markets on Europe. And those are the elements that we've applied the dynamic testing to that is leading us to hold more capital overall. So while spreads are indicative of it, it is not entirely down to spreads. We do not disclose the specifics around where we are on the actual credit spreads themselves.
Yeah, it's Marcus Barnard from Royal Securities. Can I just ask if being open or partially open to new business has been a factor or an obstacle to any negotiations you've had in the past, including valuation?
No. Next.
Right, next to you, Jane. Hello, it's Barry Corns, Premier Gordon. Just a question on the enhanced annuity product that you intend to launch. Just wondered where you're getting the experience for that. Are you doing it in conjunction with anybody else? And also linked into that, the effect of the profitability of the standard lives annuity book that you'll then be writing.
So the answer to your question, first question is yes, we are doing it in conjunction with a partner. And in terms of the impact on our existing business we're writing, we already reflect the experience on that in the way we price and approach that business at the moment. So clearly, as part of our plan to expand significantly in the retirement income space, we are building our capability on knowledge and understanding around longevity, and a critical part of that was, as we've mentioned before, was hiring Richard Willetts, who's one of the leading industry experts on longevity. He joined us in June of last year. He's been the driver of the postcode annuity pricing model I mentioned earlier on as well. So we are working in partnership with others, but we're building the internal capability as well.
Andrew Crean, Autonomous. One follow-up question. The AXA loan notes, where you have to pay capital and interest, do you have a plan? Is the market available for you to change those into hybrids, longer-dated hybrids, which would allow you to pay a higher level of dividend from the 400 million, because you wouldn't have to be paying back capital?
The answer is, do we have options? Yes. And clearly, as you say, one of the options would be to restructure that into lower tier two. We could at that point either then choose as a business to return the element of capital that represents to shareholders, or to look at the extent to which that would be available to increase the dividend. Either would be options.
And do you think the market conditions are available at the moment for you to do that? To replace it?
I think they're beginning to come available, but clearly we need to look at that amongst everything else that we need to do with the business.
Greg, that's the last question. All right, first and last. All right, just a quick question is, there hasn't been a reference to Solvency II, and during the results season, your competitors have been quite aggressively commenting on it. I was wondering if that was one of the considerations, the movements that happened in Solvency II in delaying this this buyback. And the second thing is, this is just, having been a close watcher of Phoenix, and has seen how it has actually derated relative to its to the underlying market, to markets of its EV, etc., over the last period. I was wondering, why are you splitting up your business into heritage funds when you've got a case study out there that hasn't been successful? Is this something you're going to do differently? What are your observations on that? I mean, just interested in your thoughts in that regard.
We haven't said much on Solvency II because we'd like to know what it is and when it's going to happen. It's pretty frustrating that it's still very uncertain, moving around at a rate of knots week by week, and lack of clarity on when it's going to happen. So I tend to deal in the known and tangible.
I think we did say, Greg, that where Solvency II ends up, and we separate the business into the two business units, at a legal entity level, that Solvency II will be a factor in all of that. But we are, we're quite conscious that we didn't sort of overload on Solvency II today because, we're getting on with the business. And whilst the policymakers sort of, gone a random walk. And so we need to get on with things, really. On the second point, I don't want to comment on anybody else. I think that we believe that with the right financing structure, with the proper presentation to the market, with the right leadership team and management team, and with the right ongoing support from our shareholders and debt holders, that indeed we will be able to create a very successful business model that the debt markets and equity markets will want to participate in. And we're not deterred by any live examples today that suggest that's not the case.
Okay. There are no more questions. Thank you very much for coming along today, and travel safely.